Today's Teisho will be on case 35 in the Momonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 35 is entitled, Seijo's Soul is Separated. Goso said to his monks, Seijo's soul separated from her being. Which was the real Seijo? Mumon's comment, when you realize what the real is, you will see that we pass from one husk to another like travelers stopping for a night's lodging. But if you do not realize it yet, I earnestly advise you not to rush about wildly. When earth, water, fire, and air suddenly separate, you will be like a crab struggling in boiling water with its 7 or 8 arms and legs. When that happens, don't say I didn't warn you. Mumon's verse, the moon above the clouds is ever the same. Valleys and mountains are separate from each other. All are blessed, all are blessed. Are they one or are they two? Last night we had our beginning meditation, beginner's meditation. And a number of new people came to sit. And at the end of the period, the second meditation period, I went around and asked people how it went. What did they think of the experience? And many people spoke very well of their first experience of sitting, of meditation. And I had announced a little earlier, I said, if you enjoyed this tonight, please come tomorrow, because we have half a day of meditation tomorrow, and you can come at 11 o'clock and just hear a talk on Zen practice. So people might have thought, a talk on Zen practice, that sounds interesting. And that does sound interesting. It sounds like they might come here, people might come here, and then basically I would be talking about maybe, what do you do when your legs hurt, or how do you deal with the breath when the breath doesn't seem to be doing what you want it to do, which cushion do you think, I could give a talk on cushions, maybe there's pluses and minuses, There's the buckwheat cushion, very flexible, but then there's the K-pop cushion, and maybe people might expect that. In our society, a talk on something would seem to be like that. That's like a lecture in school, right? If you come to hear the quote-unquote talk on Zen practice, it doesn't have that character at all. It's not a systematic. It's not demonstrative. I don't talk about what do you do when, how do you, coping with the such and such problem, Instead, I read these crazy stories, So they often make almost no sense at all, and they're very poetic and hard to understand. And it's possible to say, well, what kind of talk is that? What kind of talk is that? The Zen view is that the first kind of talk wouldn't really be of much help to you. And the Zen view is it's a second kind of talk, even if at the time it seems to have no meaning or value, it might ultimately be very, very important. I remember reading about a very famous Zen master, and he would give Teisho, and he was very soft-spoken. And he would speak so quietly that all the monks would have to strain to hear him speak. And not only that, but he sort of mumbled. And so, you know, going to Taisho was this frustrating, mystifying experience. You know, they'd go in, maybe they would have real questions about their sitting, you know, and maybe they'd be in, you know, go in the middle of a very rigorous training period, and you know, maybe they were hoping to have somebody give them a pep talk and say, come on, you know, we can do this, you know. And instead, there was this old man at the front of the room, you know, this little old man, and he would be mumbling and barely audible, you know. And interestingly, one of his students wrote a book. And he said, now in my mind, those talks are like thunder. You know, and I think that's very interesting. You know, the Zen way of communication is not to speak to the top layer of your mind, so to speak. You know, when you meditate, when you're following the breath actually sort of takes you down through the layers of the mind. This is not the way people normally understand what they're doing, but if you begin to be aware of what's happening on the cushion, you're watching the breath, and as you just watch the breath, you're beginning to move down through the different layers of the mind, through the different levels of your consciousness. And the mind isn't one excuse me. The mind isn't one thing. You know, the mind has different, you could say, layers or levels. And as you're meditating, as you're watching the breath, you begin to move down through the layers of the mind. That's one way to think about it. And so the top layer of your mind is the part of your mind that says, you know, I've got to get, tax time is coming up, you know, where are those receipts, you know. And under that layer of your mind, there's another layer of your mind. And people spend a lot of time on the cushion in this, sort of in this layer. And it's not the crisp layer that thinks in words and sentences and reasons. It's under that layer. There's a layer that's sort of like fragments of thoughts, like a running river of sort of mental chatter. Right? And if people spend a lot of time there. And then there's deeper layers of the mind. You know, you can get to a place where, images form, or you have very powerful memories and emotional responses. Basically you can get to a place which is very, very still, very still. And there's a real still, empty place somewhere, you could say, at the core of your mind. When Zen teachers talk, they're really trying to address sort of the deeper part of your mind. There's a kind of deeper layers of your mind. And there's a kind of, in Zen, we believe there's an unconscious mind. There's an unconscious mind, which is actually very powerful. And so, you know, these talks in Zen are not meant to speak to that superficial layer of your mind that reasons and plans and so on. It's really, you could say it's really talking to your deeper unconscious mind. And the unconscious mind has its own sort of vocabulary and its own sort of a way of processing information. You know, I have been married for something like 34 years. More than that. So many I don't even remember. But the thing is that I'll be talking to my wife, and we will be having conversations about things that happened 30 years ago. And I'll say, do you remember when we went out to Chaco Canyon? And there was that horse in the corral, and it was like that white horse. And, you know, she'll say, no, no, the horse wasn't white. You know, it was red. You know, and we'll get into this big thing. You know, or she'll say there was that wasn't no, that wasn't at Chaco Canyon. There wasn't any horse. You know, and or I'll say, you remember that rainstorm that came? No, no, that was a you know, you know. Maybe if we could go into a time machine, we could find out whether the horse was red or white, you know, or roan colored, you know, sort of reddish or white. But you know, it's not necessarily a failure of memory, right? You know, what happens consciously and what happens unconsciously are different things, you know? So in my mind, things were very important to me in a certain way, and I remember them in a certain way, you know? And that what I remember isn't what happened. What I remember is what happened to me. You know, what I remember is the deeper, are the deeper experiences that spoke to me powerfully, you know? So what we often remember is not the, you know, not like fact. It's what happened to us. And its meaning is not necessarily like rational meaning, but it's the truth for our unconscious selves. It's a truth that's for our unconscious self. You know, when I was a little boy, I had a good friend whose name was Mark Miller. And Mark Miller had jet black hair. And he moved away when we were living in Baltimore. He moved away. And I missed Mark so much, I used to actually cry. And I remember for a while that I used to have dreams about having a black dog, you know. And later, my mother bought my brother and me a dog, not a black dog, a collie. But I had these dreams about a black dog. And I realized, you know, now as an adult, I was dreaming about my friend Mark, you know, who wasn't really a dog. You know, but in my unconscious mind, he was a dog. You know, he was my friend. I played with him. It was like going out and having a dog you could play with. So, you know, the literal truth is that he was a boy living in Baltimore, you know. But in the world of my unconscious mind, Mark was a black dog, you know. And when the black dog, when Mark went away, I dreamed of playing with this black dog, and you know, sometimes I would wake up very sad because my black dog was gone. So you know, the mind is very complicated, and so these koans are really speaking to us at a deeper level than just you know, sort of TED talks. You know, I don't know if you are familiar with TED talks, but. You know, this is reaching down into the unconscious mind, and Zen believes, believe it or not, that you know, Zen believes that the unconscious mind has this power to help us wake up. You know, the Western view is that you have a conscious mind and an unconscious mind, and the unconscious mind is sort of like a memory bank where things are stored. But it doesn't really necessarily have any special importance. But in the Zen view, in the Buddhist view, all human beings have enlightened mind at their core already. So somewhere inside you already, you are enlightened. This is the basic Zen teaching. This is a basic, you already have it. You just have to get to it. Or open up and let it out. This might seem very hard to believe, but if you think about it, you know, people have a kind of goodness, even if they had difficult upbringing, bad parents. You know, it's always amazing to see people who have come from difficult circumstances manifest this extraordinary compassion and kindness. You know, where does that come from? And the Zen view, the Buddhist view, the Mahayana Buddhist view, is that every human being already contains enlightened mind. At the core of your consciousness is this enlightened mind. And the enlightened mind is trying to help you all the time to wake up. And we don't always pay attention to it. You know, sometimes we're very cynical and we don't really believe it's possible that this could be true. But it's trying all the time to help us wake up. And the problem is, you know, we get very distracted. We get very tangled up. And we become imprisoned by our mental habits. So you know, in a certain way, the human being is this extraordinary Buddha who, you know, gets drunk and punches people in the face and is angry and fearful. You know, this is the human being. It's sort of tragic, but it doesn't have to be that way. All the time, inside yourself, there's this beautiful, enlightened mind trying to help you wake up. That's the Zen view. So when we come in here and we do Zazen, we're just making ourselves very, very still, very, very quiet. Little by little, this enlightened mind works its way out. It's like, if you've ever seen a chick trying to get out of an egg, you know, the chick is trying to get out of the egg and it's pecking. And the mother hen sometimes sees the chick trying to get out and it pecks from the other side, you know. Well, there's an enlightened mind trying to get out inside of you, and, you know, something like Zen is like a mother hen trying to get in and help you get out, yeah? So anyway, if this all seems very strange, it's like, you know, you come here and you're expecting maybe a quote-unquote talk on Zen practice, and what you're getting instead are these strange stories and these incoherent discussions and so on. You know, hang on to your hats or hang on to your seats. You know, be a little patient because... You know, I used to, you know, when I started practicing with Genki Roshi, his teishos too were just like, what was that all about? You know, there was no point, there was no moral, there was no closure. You know, it would just, he'd start talking about something and then something else and something else. He'd talk about making noodles, he'd talk about, you know, trees in the fall, he'd talk about, you know, his teacher, he'd talk about going to the bathroom, he'd talk about sake, which he loved, you know. And you, at the end of the whole thing, you think, what is that? You know, here it is 40 years later, and I can, I'll just be sitting, and something he said will come back to me. You know? And that's the power of the deeper mind, the deeper mind. You know, so the proper way to listen to teishos is not like, years ago we had somebody who would come here and actually take notes. And I said, please don't do that. You know, that's a totally wrong spirit, you know. And he would be, these are very valuable insights. They're like, no, you know, don't do that. Just, you know, trust yourself. You know, you sort of sit on the cushion, you sort of treat this like a meditation event. You're meditating, you're sort of listening with part of your mind. And, you know, it's possible 40 years from now, something that I talk about might still resonate with you the way things that Genki Roshi said to me still resonate. So this is a story that is a little bit crazy, you know, a little bit strange, because it's meant to speak to this deeper part of your mind. There is a Chinese ghost, you could say like a ghost story, about a woman named Seijo. And she's a little, you know, when she was a little girl living in this village in China, she had a friend down the street. There was a little boy she used to play with. And so Seijo and her little boyfriend, you know, would be doing everything together. They'd go, you know, walk through the rice fields together. They'd play, they'd throw stones in the water together. Every day they'd get up and they'd want to see each other, and people in the village would see them walking through the streets and they'd say, there goes the old couple, right? Because this little boy and this little girl were like inseparable companions, and they'd say, there's the old couple again, you know. These two little kids would be walking sort of hand in hand through the street. So anyway, if you flash forward, say, 15 years, now Seijo is a young woman, and her parents want her to marry. This was a time in all cultures, not just China, but in Europe too. You know, you didn't marry the person you wanted; you married the person who was going to be helpful to your family, right? So Seijo's parents, you know, they're looking for a good match for her. They're looking for somebody who will be, you know, good for her, but also good for the family. And they line up a young man who's, you know, intelligent, well-educated. But Seijo doesn't want to marry him. She's still in love with the little boy she used to play with, who's now a young man. And her parents, you know, they say, look, you know, you've got to grow up. You've got to be an adult. You have to, you know, do your responsibility, you know, for all of us. And you've got to marry this other guy. You can't marry your childhood boyfriend. So Seijo's in great distress about this, and her boyfriend is in great distress, you know. And then they do something which is unthinkable in Chinese culture at the time, which is they disobey their parents. And they flee. They leave the village at night, in the dead of night, and they sail away and they go to to Taiwan or someplace like that, an island. And they make a life for themselves together. You know, they get married there, they have a house, they have children, and they have a very happy life, you know, built on their love, you know. But Seijo starts getting... starts feeling sad because she misses her mother and her father. She feels that something is really missing in her life. She's a little bit guilty, maybe, about what she did, but she just loves them and wishes they could be part of her life. So she you know, just can't get over this, and she says to her husband, you know, I miss my mother and I miss my father so much. Why don't we go back and explain to them what happened and tell them about our lives? We haven't, you know, we've lived good lives. We've been good people. And so the husband says, okay, if this troubles you that much, let's go back. So they sail back to Seijo's old village, you know, and when they get there, they leave the kids, maybe, I don't know with who, but they leave the kids. This is a story, so we don't have to worry about all the details. But they leave the kids, and then they get back to outside. They sail back to the village, and then Seijo says to her husband, "You know, I'm so nervous. I'm so afraid my parents are going to reject me, and they're going to be mad at me, and they're going to be deeply hurt. That I just can't go right now. Would you go first? You know?" And the husband says, "Sure, I'll go first." So he goes into the village and he finds their house, and he knocks at the door, and they come out. The two parents come out, and he says, "Do you remember me?" And they say, "Well, not necessarily. We don't remember you very well, you know." And then he says, "Do you?" He said, "I'm the man who eloped with your daughter Seijo. Do you remember, you know, 15 years ago, or 10 years ago, Seijo and I stole out in the dead of night. Well, we sailed away to an island, and we got married, and we've been living, and we have children." And these people are looking at him like he's totally crazy. And then they say, "What are you talking about? You eloped with Seijo. Seijo's right here in our house." They said, "She's upstairs." And they said, "You know, we wanted her to marry somebody, and she just didn't want to do it. And she refused, and she refused, and then she became ill, and she got a terrible illness, and she's been in her room ever since, on the edge of death." And he can't believe it, because he knows, you know, I ran away with Seijo 10 years ago. So they all go up to the bedroom, and in the bed he sees his wife, you know, and she's obviously been deeply depressed, you know, and she's listless, and her eyes are empty, and her face is very pale. And he can't believe it. You know, he feels like he's losing his mind. And he says, how's this possible? You know, I ran away with Seja. So anyway, he goes out of the house and runs down to the dock. And he gets his wife and he brings her up. And in the story, you know, she comes through the door and the parents see her and they're amazed. What? How is this possible? And then they take her upstairs, and they all go upstairs with the happy Seijo. And the sick Seijo is in the bed, and the happy Seijo comes in, and they move towards each other, and they become one. See, that's the story. So, you know, this is, I think, really powerful, powerful story that's speaking to us on a deep level. It seems like just one of these, it seems like something you might have seen on the Twilight Zone when you were 12 or something. But it has very deep, deep importance, right? I mean, and there's many ways we experience this. You know, many ways we experience this kind of dividedness. You know, in this story, Seijo is, and this is a very Asian story in some ways, because Seijo has to do something that society expects her to do, but it kills her to do it, right? So you know, especially in a society like China, you know, doing your duty to your society, your family, is number one. And yet sometimes you have to do things that just kill you inside, right? You know, they just kill your spirit. So this is a story about maybe somebody who had a choice, right? Go away and be free and happy, or do what society expects and suffer this like soul death, you know. And all over the Asian world, this was and probably still is a very common experience, you know. I think when people in the Asian world, and Japanese people, you know, they hear this story, and this is so resonant for them, because so often, you know, Japanese people get to pick their own spouses now, but nevertheless, you know, Japan's very duty-oriented society, very collective society. You know, when I used to study tea ceremony, you know, one of the first lessons of tea ceremony is that when you're offered a bowl of tea, you never accept it. When you're given a bowl of tea, you offer it to the person next to you, and then they have to decline before you can drink it. See, and my second teacher, Webb Roshi, used to say the lesson is, see, always others before the self. This is very, very Buddhist, but also very Japanese attitude. Others before the self, see. So in a culture like that, you're giving up your dreams sometimes. You're giving up your freedom in order to do the right thing. But it kills you, and it robs you of your personal happiness, you see. So you know, in America, we have similar dilemmas, right? We often do things that we don't want to do or that aren't satisfying, and maybe they're even like soul deadening, but we have to do them, you know. I was reading the other day that dentists have a very high suicide rate. You might not know that. But apparently dentists have a very, very high suicide rate. And I wonder if it's not that, you know, basically people choose, not always. I have a great dentist. She's a wonderful, I would recommend her highly if you need a good dentist. She's very funny and has a lovely spirit. But I think some people get into dentistry because they think it's going to be economically secure. And it's a respected profession. And then, you know, maybe it's not that interesting for some people, you know. And apparently the people get, dentists suffer from fairly high rates of depression, you know. And I think, you know, depression in our society is very high rate of depression. And I think it's because maybe we don't really live a life. The life we have to live doesn't correspond to the things we need on a deeper level to be nourished and feel alive, you know. In fact, you know, I think in some ways depression is the disease of our time. You know, it's really the disease of our time because, you know, on some level maybe we feel like we have to do things, but they don't nourish our spirit, you know. I know that I meet a fairly large number of students as a teacher. You know, I meet a fairly large number of students who are really just they're taking the courses they know they have to take. You know, and they're not necessarily getting anything out of it, you know. Their parents are making them go into accounting, or their parents are making them go into business, and, you know, they don't really have much conviction. They're just doing it to do it. So I think even here in the West, where we often think we have a lot of freedom, we're constantly caught between what we have to do and what we want to do, or what would be liberating, or what would make us feel alive, you know. So this koan is really speaking to this kind of a contradiction. In our lives, you know, we all have this kind of contradiction, these kinds of contradictions. But there's other ways to understand the koan, or other ways we experience the koan, you know. Lately, I have had a number of friends who have had cancer, you know, have cancer. First of my friends who had cancer, this happened about 12 years ago, but she had Hodgkin's lymphoma. But it was normally that's not that serious, but they were really worried about her. It was like very, you know, they thought she might not make it. I used to go to her house and meditate with her like a couple times a week. And we would talk, and she would talk about the experience of having Hodgkin's lymphoma. And she said, it's so weird. She said, I go to the hospital, she said, and I have to take off all my clothes, and they draw little things on my body. She said, they draw little bullseyes on my body. And then they shoot the bullseyes with radiation. And after the radiation treatment, she felt very, very exhausted, you know. So she said she would go to the hospital, you know, take off her clothes. These people are standing over her, marking up her body. And then this device is coming down and sort of blasting her with radiation. And she said it was all very, it made her feel sad to go through this process. And she'd come home and be very tired from the treatments. So, you know, she said to me, I just can't believe this is happening to me, right? You know, I can't believe this is happening to me. You know, what she wanted to have happen was very, you know, what we want to do is be healthy, you know, running with the wind in our hair, you know. And she's on a table, and they're marking her up and blasting her with little beams of radiation. And so this is another experience of this, right? I was just talking to somebody who's much younger than I am, who had been really like head over heels in love, just head over heels. He was the happiest I've seen him, as the relationship was moving towards like maybe marriage. His girlfriend fell in love with somebody else. And this person was just devastated, right? And, you know, this happened to me. You know, it happens to people, right? You know, and, but at the time, it just seems like this, it's like, how can this be happening to me, right? You know, what he imagined, you know, was something very different, right? He was dreaming of a life with this person, you know? I mean, people get it, you know, what will our kids look like, you know? Where will we live? Maybe, you know, he'd look at houses and think, maybe we could live in a house like that, you know? And now she's living in a house like that with somebody else, you know? So very painful and difficult. And you think, how, you know, I can't believe this is happening to me. So these are all sort of like Seijo situations. See, we all have these splits, right? These splits. Here's another one that's interesting, kind of a split. Sometimes you come in and you sit down on the cushion, you straighten your back, and you breathe with your hara, your dantian. And your mind, you know, you come into the zendo, maybe it's been a difficult day, and you come here maybe in the evening, or you're sitting at home, and you're stressed or something's really bothering you. You sit down on the cushion and you start watching your breath, you start meditating, and, you know, your breath takes you down through the layers of the mind and you get to this very, very still place, you know? And maybe to your surprise, you find that your tension goes away and your distress, your emotional distress begins to disappear. And suddenly you're in this very serene state, you know. It's when you're in that, if you've been meditating for a while, this happens sometimes. You get to this place where, this imperturbable place that's very serene, very balanced, very calm. And when you look back at your problems, they just seem so remote, so remote. It's like, why was I upset about that, right? You know, you can get to this place, it's very beautiful. This is a wonderful place to be, you know. And then basically the meditation stops, you get off the cushion, you go home, you go to bed, you get up, and then the next day there's the stresses and so on. And the meditation probably helps, but sometimes you feel this sense of a split, right? You know, when I'm on the cushion and I'm in deep samadhi, I'm so calm and self-possessed. I have so much ability to deal with my fears. But when I'm here in my office and people are coming in and throwing things on the floor, you know, that just seems to evaporate. You know? Or here's another one, you know. In our tradition, we do these retreats called sesshin. And people meditate. You go to a sesshin for, say, 5 days or 7 days. And eventually, at first they're very difficult, but eventually around day three of the sesshin, you just get to this place where it's as though all obstacles are gone and everything has a kind of perfection about it. Perfect. Perfect. You know, you're open and your heart is open and that compassionate Buddha nature is right there on the surface. Well, you know, you leave sesshin and you come home and the next, you know, a week later you're tense and you're worried and so on. And there's a sense of a split, yeah? So this koan is really all about this feeling we have in various ways of being separate from the life that's actually unfolding around us. This sense that we're separate from our own life, separate from our life. And if you begin to meditate and you continue to do it, you'll notice that in everyday consciousness, you know, there is a kind of separation all the time. It's very subtle, but you know, it's often the case that we're not really 100% with what is happening around us. You know, it's something we don't normally notice. But if you meditate for a while, you'll notice. When you're not meditating, sometimes there's a slight sense of pulling back, you know? We're not really 100% present most of the time, you know? We're 40% present or 30% present or 20% present. And there's a kind of instinctive, almost like instinctive separation between ourselves and the world that's unfolding, you know? Yesterday, in my job, I have a job, I'm sort of like a school principal. You know, I run this writing program, and I'm sort of like the principal of the school. So I get calls from unhappy parents, you know, and you know, some of those parents are nice, and some of them are just awful, you know. And this guy was awful. He wasn't even supposed to meet with me yesterday. He was supposed to meet with somebody else. But he was so difficult to deal with. I don't teach on Friday. So I was working at home, and I got a call from my secretary, and she said, "You better come in here." I was like, "Oh, I was writing something. It was finally, I was getting something done, you know. I'm writing, I'm in the middle of a paragraph, and my secretary calls and said, "You better come in here, you know." And this person had insulted everybody in the building. He was just a monster, you know. He really was. He was awful. He's actually emotionally disturbed, I would say. Yeah, and no question, you know. And his son had failed this class, and basically he was just, you know, it was like he was just punishing everybody in the building. And he went to the department chair's secretary, and he was a monster. And then he went to the various people, and when I met with them later, they were shell-shocked, right? This guy was so difficult to work with. So anyway, you know, I had to work with him myself, you know, and he was incredibly difficult. And, you know, I mean, I was sitting there talking to him, and there's a part of me saying, "I can't believe this is happening," right? You know? It's like, "I can't believe this is happening." And, you know, I would rather be in my home working on my paragraph right now, you know. So we all have this, right? You know, the Zen view is that this is this, you know, we have to learn how to enter deep samadhi. We have to learn how to enter deep samadhi, and in deep samadhi, we feel the connectedness of things very powerfully. We feel this very strong sense of connectedness. When we're in deep samadhi, we feel as though there's no obstacles sometimes in all directions. But the Zen view is that that is reality, and the fantasy or the false view is that you're separate from things happening around you, you know. So what we have to do, and it takes many years, is we learn how to get into deep samadhi. And then gradually we integrate more and more of what is happening in our life into that circle of unity, which we achieve sometimes when we sit on the cushion. Yeah? And sometimes it's hard, you know? But little by little, we pull back less and less from the events that happen to us. Sometimes it's possible just to be spontaneously at one with whatever happens. This happens to all of us sometimes. You know, sometimes you get up, you go to work, and you're just with it. You know, whatever happens, it's okay. Flat tire, not a problem. You know? And you just keep moving, and it's all okay. You know? Sometimes that happens. And that, in Zen practice, that's really, that's part of what we're up to in all of this sitting, is getting to this point where nothing stops us, nothing arrests us or creates that sense of separation. Everything is my true self. Everything is my true self. This is the Zen view. Now, it's hard to say. Yesterday, listening to this guy scream, I did not feel like that was my true self. Right? So today I had extra motive to sit, extra motive to practice. You know. And through much of the first part of my sit, he was still screaming at me, you know, in my mind, in my unconscious mind. He's gone in reality, but in my unconscious, he's still there screaming and menacing me. Okay. So basically, this sense of separation is part of being a human being. And it is what we mean when we speak in Buddhism about samsara. Samsara is this sense of separateness. And, you know, the point of our practice as Zen, point of Zen practice is to gradually first discover that deep state of oneness that we find sometimes on the cushion. And it can take years to get there. And sometimes when we get there, we're just there for a little while. But that deepens and deepens and deepens and deepens. And then, you know, we want to widen that circle, extend that circle until it takes in more and more and more. You know, if you read these stories of Zen teachers, you read stories about Zen masters, you know, These stories are sometimes just so weird, but you're dealing with people who don't stop. They're not arrested by anything that happens to them. You know, very accomplished people in the Zen path, there's a saying in Zen, everything becomes your rice. See, everything becomes your rice. You know, that guy in my office yesterday, it didn't feel like my rice, but it's if I work on myself enough, if I work on the cushion and off the cushion enough, you know, I'll be able to experience that as something that made my world bigger, not smaller, that opened me up and not closed me down, right? So, you know, this is what the Seijo koan is really saying. You know, we all experience this sense of separateness. And, you know, we must be, you know, basically courageous about not allowing ourselves to hide behind that separation or to live with that separation. You know, to be a Zen person, a woman of Zen or a man of Zen, is to constantly push against those limits, you know. Constantly, you know. So you do what is, sometimes in Zen, you have to do what is difficult to wake up more deeply, you know. So we might think of Zen as involving, you know, sitting on a cushion until you have an enlightenment experience. And indeed, that is part of Zen. But the ultimate goal is to bring everything into this circle of awakening. Or you could, another way to put it is circle of trust. Everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. If you say that all the time, you know, it's true, and you know, you will. It will be a wonderful guide to your practice, guide to your life, and a guide to your practice. And you come in sometimes, and your legs hurt, you know, and you can say, "God damn it," you know. I wanted to have a peaceful sit, and my legs are killing me. You know, say everything is helping me to wake up. You know, even pain. You know, something nobody wants pain, but you know, if you can work through your pain, you know, you open up in the most beautiful way. And if you can work through somebody yelling at you in your office, you know, you can open up in the most beautiful way. Gosho said to his monks, "Seijo's soul is separated from her being. Which is the real Seijo? Which is the real? Everything is the real Seijo. Everything in your life is the real Seijo. Everything is your true self." Mumon's comment, "When you realize that everything is your true self, you will see that we pass from one husk to another like travelers stopping for a night's lodging." So you know, every day is like a new life, and you know, we can move out into this bigger circle, out into a bigger circle, out into a bigger circle. You know, it's like being reborn over and over again. Sometimes things kill us, right? They stop us dead in our tracks. They make us sort of die inside. You know, but if we keep practicing, we keep pushing, and we keep entering samadhi, you know, it's like everything becomes your rice. Every experience is like a new opportunity to be reborn, like being reborn. So you will see that we pass from one husk to another, one birth to another, like travelers stopping at a night's lodging. But if you do not realize it yet, I earnestly advise you not to rush about wildly. When earth, water, fire, and air suddenly separate, you will be like a crab struggling in boiling water with its 7 or 8 arms and legs. In other words, do your zazen every day. You know, if you want this ability, you know, please cultivate your zazen. Mumon's verse. "The moon above the clouds is always the same. That in that deep samadhi state, everything is perfect. That's your Buddha nature. Valleys and mountains are separate from each other. All are blessed. All are blessed. Are they one or are they two?"